Welcome to Hedson's Living Histories podcast, capturing and sharing the life stories of people who have used or worked in NHS mental health services in Sussex, following the closure of the old asylums in the 1980s, up to and including the COVID-19 pandemic and its aftermath. By listening to people tell us, in their own words, about their experiences, we explore the complex interplay between mental health and a life well lived. Over the course of a year, Living Histories volunteers have recorded 35 in-depth oral history interviews across Sussex, opening up new ways to reflect on the past, present and future impact of mental health on people's lives. The full interviews will remain sealed for 80 years in the Mass Observation Archive at the Keep, housed in the University of Sussex. But in these podcasts, with the permission of the interviewees, we present some of their memories, experiences and reflections for the first time. You might find some of the stories you hear challenging, as participants talk openly about the difficulties of living with mental ill health. Please be aware that topics including mental health crisis, suicide, abuse and neglect are covered in these episodes. Living Histories celebrates the strength, courage and resilience of people living with mental health problems and those caring for them. Our huge thanks to everyone who told their story. This episode, Good Days and Bad Days, documents how the COVID-19 pandemic of 2020 to 2021 was experienced by people using and working in NHS mental health services, as we consider how people's lives and support systems were impacted by the greatest health crisis in living memory. On the 23rd of March 2020, the then Prime Minister Boris Johnson announced the first COVID lockdown in the UK, telling people to stay home, protect our NHS and save lives, introducing strict curbs on life in the UK, including the requirement to only leave your home for work if it was absolutely necessary and you could not work from home. There followed over a year of lockdowns and social distancing, transforming daily life and NHS services in many ways forever. Whilst mental distress often brings periods of profound loneliness and loss, it also sparks creativity, endurance and connection. This episode explores the emotional realities of living with mental ill health throughout the pandemic, highlighting how people find strength in difficult times and how, for some, the periods of lockdown brought quiet relief as the lived reality of mental health was shared by the population at large.
When COVID happened, I was living independently in my flat, but they suggested that I move up to my parents' house. I stayed up there for the whole time, really. When we could start going out, I'd go out for a walk every day around Hove Park, and I did start meeting a friend who I met at Autism Sussex, who has the same diagnosis as me. We'd go for a coffee and a walk along the seafront. But I was really glad when things got back to normal, because I started getting a bit of OCD as well, where I was sort of like pointing things out and doing things in rituals when I was sort of just going for a walk down the road, because I was finding it very stressful, really. When things opened back up again, I started to relax a little bit more, but I found that time quite difficult, really, and a bit isolating, really. I was glad when things got back to normal.
The first thing that springs to mind, I guess because it's more recent, is COVID. I think that was really particularly difficult for people with mental health issues and staff working in mental health. The normal ways in which you would work with an individual, show some care, sit close, not have your nose and mouth covered. You know, all of those things were particularly difficult, I think, for all kinds of staff and people who were kind of touching in our service. Obviously things like domestic violence were worse, drug and alcohol sales seemed to carry on, and so there were people in great distress on their own, or young people that had moved home with parents that weren't used to seeing the level of distress or paranoia perhaps that they were showing. It was really difficult times. From a lead nurse point of view, we would have government 3 or 4 times a day perhaps sending out things to the NHS, and then our quality and governance would have to try and translate that into something that would work for mental health. I mean, just silly things that are obvious things, like taking your PPE off outside a room. Well, you can't do that if it has to go in a bin that somebody can throw at you. You can't use masks and that might be around that somebody might use as a ligature. You can't, there was so much about it that was so difficult, and obviously there would have been members of staff that were having really difficult things going on in their private lives as well, and people, you had to go into work because you felt that, you know, moral obligation, but you were also really frightened of somebody you had at home. And we've got quite an ageing population of doctors and nurses particularly, and it was really difficult for some of those to kind of work out there, yeah, what's right for them to do.
I got COVID early on and I ended up spending 10 days in hospital. And that was a very scary time, because that was at a time in the early days where, you know, a lot of people weren't coming back out of hospital alive. You know, and I spent 10 days lying on my front. Thankfully, I didn't have to have an induced coma or anything like that. But I was extremely unwell. And when I was discharged, it's hard to say because of everything else going on. But I don't think I ever actually fully recovered from it. I was very weak when I came out of hospital. I'd lost a lot of weight.
I guess the pandemic, which was, it hit hardest, it caused obviously, you know, an increase in mental health problems across the board, but the people who were hardest hit were people who had pre-existing serious mental illness. And I suppose I witnessed that in terms of the other peer support workers. I guess it brought lots of sort of disadvantages out to the surface, and I think the thing, well, one of many things, is it sort of felt like the people that it's going to affect the most were actually not given any additional support. If anything, were pushed further away. I know lots of staff who, you know, we lost through the pandemic, not as in, well, some, you know, had died from COVID-19, but I guess the psychological impact that some are unable to work, some were unable to carry on in their roles within the trust for various reasons and inequalities at the time, and it had a massive impact.
I was one of the individuals who caught COVID, and I was admitted to hospital. When I caught COVID, I stayed at home, because the encouragement was that symptoms will get better. I stayed at home for more than a week. Something also shifted in my thinking regarding isolation. It's not easy to be isolated. I remember people coming, it was early stages of COVID, people coming and they would ring me, say, we brought you food. Then I'll go downstairs to pick up my food. And these are colleagues that I work with. These are people that I associate with daily. You open the door, you find groceries, but you don't see the person who bought the groceries. They've gone already. They can't be in front of you because they are fearful of touching COVID, catching COVID. So that was difficult. Spending 2 weeks in your room on your own without going out, because you are not allowed. Government was saying stay in if you have got symptoms. When I think back, that was very difficult. And it sort of brings me to life in my everyday work. When someone says to you, I live on my own, there's no community support, they're not linked to any network. You think about those experiences and you say you have to do everything possible to get it better for people.
So I worked with young asylum seekers, so up to the age of 18. I mean, I was the only person looking after the mental health of these young people at the time. Obviously, there was, like, you know, I had a manager and a supervisor kind of overseeing me, but I was the only nurse. They had their social workers and they were amazing, and they noticed and looked and, you know, if there were things going on. But the impact that COVID had on these young people was massive. If you can imagine that they came from places where they'd been kind of locked up in back of lorries, they'd been locked up in, you know, prison kind of type places, like in Libya. A lot of the African people would come over and they'd end up in Libya and they'd sort of be treated as, you know, slave labour, and they'd have to be sort of locked in rooms at night time on their journeys over the places. And then when they came here, they would describe it being like that again, because they'd have to be shut in their bedrooms on their own, scared that they were going to die. So of course all their trauma would come back and the distress would all come back. And the one good thing that they had was safety and connection with people that can keep them safe. And then all of a sudden that went again. So then I couldn't go and see them initially. So that worried me a lot, because I thought things are getting worse for them, but I can't kind of protect them. And I did feel very responsible for them. And I did care about them a lot as well. I was very close to a lot of them. But it just made me reflect on how lucky I was during that time, that I had my own home. I had my friend living with me at the time. She came and lived with me. You know, I was just so grateful that I could go and buy food. We could go for a walk up on the South Downs. I could have a gin and tonic at the end of the day, you know, but all these young people couldn't. And I think that's what that job did for me, really, is built my empathy massively.
There was an element of feeling at times guilty that you weren't working on the wards in the same way, but you had to protect the wards. You couldn't just walk into them. It's one of those life experiences, isn't it? Hopefully we'll never have to experience again. And a lot of challenges of making sure that we had the right equipment for our staff, you know, the right PPE, and the fear people had. And it was a very real fear.
It was mutiny. Mutiny from the ship, shall we say. Because obviously a lot of the workforce, well, they just run for the hills. Can't possibly come in because it's COVID. I want to be very careful how I word all this, really. But some of our staff couldn't, because we have patient-facing caring roles. I, as a nurse, couldn't be sat at home working, could I? But it's surprising how many staff left and run. Psychologists didn't come in, social workers didn't come in. A few OTs came in, consultants, some came in, some avoided. But the level of anxiety in the staff was huge. You know, you'd go on a morning meeting online, people were sat in their armchairs, sat in their bedrooms even, sat with kids on their laps and what have you, telling us what we should and shouldn't do, and is X, Y, Z done? It was, sometimes I'd grit my teeth and smile sweetly.
To be honest with you, I kind of lead fairly sedentary, solitary sort of life anyway. My life really didn't change that much because of the pandemic. I was working online much harder, because my work is very much about supporting disabled artists, so the work demands increased. We were blessed with a beautiful spring and summer and autumn that year, 2020. So my kind of main memories of it are of being able to sit in the garden and work in the garden. It was a blessing to not have the constant noise of traffic and aeroplanes, and to be able to hear the birds. And oh my God, the period when there was no traffic was just utter bliss.
The pandemic was a bit surreal, interesting. I think when it started, it was like almost Ramadan, where I tend to close off to the world anyway. So it's like the whole world was closing off. So it was like kind of like, well, that makes Ramadan easier. You know, there's something about things coming more to a still, the possibility that the world could move in a direction that we can choose, because we're not doing business as usual.
I really enjoyed lockdown. I mean, despite being mentally ill and anxious at times, I do quite enjoy my own company, and I did a lot of artwork, and I didn't have any pressures, and I didn't have to go anywhere.
I don't know if there was a lockdown or not, because I was in a psych ward, so I don't know what was happening outside in the outside world. It changed the fact that everyone had a mask. the staff did. It is a bit weird to be in a place where, like, there's some people that you see every day and you don't know what their faces are. I was psychotic, so my thoughts were a little bit all over the place. But, for example, I was very keen on having food. I love food, I'm very passionate. But it meant that I was always the first in line, and the food was very, very warm, so I often got my tongue burnt. And I was convinced that every time it felt burned, because with COVID you can taste, and of course I couldn't taste as much because I burnt my tongue, I was convinced that I was dying constantly.
Actually, working here became a lot easier for me because none of these people were in the office. There was only the mental health team. It was just us using the office space. I really loved it because I've been a fan of social distancing for years. And I've always had anti-back wipes and gel in my bag. People always laughed at me. So I was like, I've been preparing for this my whole life. It's all good. So we had to work with people differently. It was okay. I was absolutely terrified of COVID, but I've never had it. Because I've always avoided people largely anyway. I don't go in big shops because that's like hell for me. I'm good in an emergency, you know, with the ADHD kind of thing it is. I always have been good in other people's crises. I took to it quite easily. Hastings Services won an award because of how responsive we were. We had some of our team going to work on the ward when that was absolutely when everyone was off sick. And, you know, we did it. I think a lot of clients found it hard not to access their usual coping, so if they're usually going out to day services, whatever, there were those things. So probably our duty desk was busier. And some people, yeah, it really struggled, but other people were quite happy with it because they didn't have to go out and they didn't have to see anyone. By the other side, you've got people that felt extremely isolated and that affected them in a very negative way. So very, very, very mixed. But we got through it. And I was almost disappointed here when it went back to normal, because that's when I had to get the reasonable adjustments. And people were in my space again, and I'm like, no, stay at least 6 feet away, please. So, yeah, actually, it was harder for me coming out of lockdowns than going into them. But, you know, a lot of people, I know that patients are breaking the rules, and not through what they're saying, but of course they were, because, yeah... difficult.
I had the best tomatoes that year because I was home, you know, after I call, go to the garden, you know, make sure, tend to, which you didn't get to do because you were, again, that concept of flexible working, I think we didn't get to it, you know, you went out at 9 and you came back at the end of the, you know, so really being at home in that period and trying to, you know, ensure all of our well-being. And I think, you know, it was scary, isn't it? It was a scary time. I think after a while, I just shut the news. I shut it out. I didn't follow the news. Oh, this many people have died, this, you know, before vaccine and everything. So just really filtered it out and just tried to, yeah, maintain my well-being by, yeah, tending to my seedlings, tending to my plants.
In a way, it was like suddenly my work was really easy. Like I'd gone from a typical week looking like me being in Hastings one day, Eastbourne the next, a London prison the day after that, like huge amounts of travel to just none. But then having my ex-partner and his children around and trying to manage that in a flat where there was just an open plan space. So I had to withdraw from some work because I couldn't do it privately. I found that quite stressful, being in your own home environment and hearing all that material and then having no one to talk to about it. But also never knowing if my partner was going to walk through the door, quite stressful too. Yeah, so I stopped doing that work.
We had to work out how to work online. Never had I done that before. Maybe a meeting every now and again. And that's still the case. And I still, now we have a team of people, but often I'm sitting in an office on my own, you know, because everyone's just working from home. For me, that's been massive, because all through my career, I don't have children. My family are kind of my friends. You know, for me, going to work is also about my own social life and my own, you know, having friends and connecting with people. But I find that really difficult now because we're such an online culture where we have everything's online, people work from home. The culture's changed. There are just loads of different services all bunched into one, you know, one building. So you're fighting over rooms. And then they say, oh, well, we might not be using that room at 4 o'clock. But by that time, you can't ring a patient up and say, or a service user up and say, come in, we've got an appointment, we've got a spare room at 4 o'clock. I mean, it's you can't work like that. You have to be able to say, okay, next week, come in at this time after school and we'll see you. And then our job is to get a room and so that we've got somewhere to see that young person in. But now we just, the access, I think, is really bad. And people do tend to work from home more. And also paperwork, well, it is a massive part of our daily work now. Whereas I think before COVID, our daily work was seeing patients, and now our daily work is doing paperwork.
It was beautifully pandemic. It was like a service that was supposed to be sat in the GP surgery, integrated in the community, and it was 2020. We had to start online. We had to start using Teams. We had to, you know, Teams channel for communication. We wouldn't see, yeah, our colleagues, even patients. It would have been absurd, you know, 10 years ago to think, oh, you're doing an assessment online. You know, maybe phone, at the last resort. So then you'd see a change in people's, and I guess it will make you, you've got to be clinically confident anyway if you are not seeing a person face to face and you're doing, you know, an assessment on intervention to be able to pick up, you know, very, very minute risk, for instance.
We are developing, we are changing, and that's never going to stop. So some things are obvious. For example, the fact that we can now hold clinics online, that's a system change. The reason I say that is because 6 years before that, I tried to put it in, and there were so many hoops and this and that and governance and guidelines and what if somebody hacked and somebody so, that in the end I said, you know what, this is now taking too much of my time. But, you know, what I was thinking at that time, I was thinking, why do you send a staff member up to Forest Row? That's an hour there, an hour with the patient, an hour coming back, an hour to document. That's half a day, half a shift to see one patient, when you can log in and have that interaction. It's probably going to take you an hour, and that's it. And some patients don't like it now. It stops them having to get the bus, stop their expense, stop unnecessary waiting, you know. Some people are anxious in the streets, or they don't want to be in public places, or this saves them that. But that was a system change. That wasn't me changing. I was looking for that change. It wasn't happening because it was rubbing up against the system. When COVID came, that system was up and running in 10 days.
Since the pandemic, lots and lots of meetings have gone online. We were already doing it before, so it wasn't so much of a change. We're used to that. We've been doing Skype meetings and things since about 2011. We worked around it. When the really strong lockdowns were in, I couldn't go and see people, so I'd offer, you know, would you like a phone call? And some people said yes and some people said no. There's somebody I meet every week, and we would sit outside and if it was raining we'd find a shelter somewhere on the seafront and sit there and chat. Generally speaking, we coped. We made the necessary changes. It didn't affect my mental health as such, except being upset that two people I know died from it. And the thing that upset me then was being confronted by a group of COVID deniers. It was all conspiracy theory stuff. I'm not sure what the two dead people would have said about that.
I was discharged from services after lockdown because I refused to engage by telephone during lockdown. I was under the Beedale at that time. But I was in a crowded house with five people in it. I was not going to find a space I could have a confidential talk, so I said no. And after that, he said, well, you've managed all this time. You can probably manage now. Off you go, which was fine by me. And I haven't been back since. I'm not a happy user of telephones even now. I can make a business call, but if I can send an email instead, I'd far rather do that than get on a phone, because I have huge anxiety around sort of initiating phone conversations. So moving it to that kind of setup, and I found I couldn't Zoom socially because there were sort of peer support groups that set up, and I found they just made me panic. I can do Zoom as a meeting, but not as a social thing. Sorry. There would have been a lot of people who probably fell through the gap then. And I probably was ready to go my own way anyway, but there were people who would have been far more vulnerable, who may have just got lost. And that worries me enormously. If people want to use technology for consultations, great, but it shouldn't ever be a default. In person should always come first, because certainly my generation, it's much safer. Younger generations are probably more happy on technology, but maybe sometimes it would be healthier for them to be seen in person, because you can hide behind technology.
We managed to keep people fairly safe and contained, but we couldn't really advance what we were trying to really achieve with somebody online or by phone. So, you know, it might be really difficult to help somebody with something they're struggling with if you can't sit in the room with them. The most obvious examples are people who experience psychosis, who are hearing voices and may not be talking very much. And they're sitting there and you can visibly see the distress they're in, and they're working with that distress, and you can help them by being with them. You can't do that on the phone.
I refused to work from home. I didn't want to work from home. I didn't want any of my family overhearing conversations. I didn't want my cat walking across the screen. I just didn't work for me. So, and they're really, really good here. So three of us, I think, stayed in the building and everything else went online. But everything went on the phones. You'd have a burning ear with the most hyperly anxious client group you can ever imagine in your life, who are already anxious, but this made them terrified and exacerbated their problems 100-fold, and with that came huge risk. And I'm grateful again for colleagues, because we supported each other through every bit, whether it was one of us needed food or whatever. And there were some wonderful gestures from outside Salvation Army, really sweet. But some staff who had only just come into working in mental health and are hearing it in their head on the phone all day long were a bit broken, I think, at times. Yeah, so it was tough. Humour, resilience, resourcefulness, and then just raw connection with service users. You know, being really honest, I'm so sorry you're in isolation. I'm so sorry. Some of them didn't ever go out again. We've still got people that never left the house. Even now, haven't left the house. They were already fairly agoraphobic. They'd started coming here, but never left the house. People that disengaged from the service. People that were quite broken by it, frightened and lonely. And some people who are okay. So positives are, my God, it's a hell of a team here. It's a hell of a team.
For some people, it probably enhanced sort of the feelings of isolation and aloneness, which probably impacted on their mental health in terms of mood. And we know that some people felt extremely isolated and then started not looking after themselves. But I also think it impacted on things like recovery, in terms of they weren't able to go out and access some of the activities that they were doing, because basically they were cancelled and shut. So even if they were quite well and it wasn't necessarily mental health services they were accessing, it could have been like the local gym. Well, if the local gym wasn't open or whatever, then they weren't going. There was definitely some of that we came across, that actually it increased people's isolation. I think it affected probably everybody, but in different ways. And I think sometimes it was quite difficult to unpick how it was impacting people. But certainly the isolation bit, I think, was a biggie.
I think lockdown has made it hard for a lot of people. A lot of people are never going to come out of lockdown. They lost their purpose, they lost their role. Kids that didn't go into school or go back to college, or I think there's a hell of a lot of isolation out there. And that's what they've grown up with. And they've never had those experiences of having fun, really. They haven't got the social skills, or they're too shy, they're too introverted, you can't get them out of the house. And I just feel it's just completely different at the moment.
So in the eating disorder service that I work in, I think our referral rate went up by about 200% during COVID, and it hasn't really calmed down since then, but the staffing hasn't gone up. I mean, it has gone up a bit. It was a very small service before sort of COVID, but and now it's a much bigger service. But it's, you know, in terms of the amount of people we're getting referred and the complexity of referrals, yeah, it's not really the resource for it at all. But, you know, people with an eating disorder, they need support straight away. They need physical health. There's risk to life. And we're like, you know, of course we respond to those people, but then it's, you know, it's really hard to help everybody straight away. So, yeah, quite a battle.
Actually, something that happened at the beginning of the pandemic, out of nowhere, so in April 2020, I got an email one day that was followed up by a phone call, which was the best way to do it, basically saying that they've just started video clinic for the autism assessments and that they had a cancellation. I had waited 8 months at that point, and they said, if you're willing to have it, I think it was in like 2 days' time, yeah, you can have it. And I just went for it. So sort of within 48 hours' notice, it was happening. And it was a 45-minute video call. I had had to do quite a lot of like extensive screening beforehand because I was seen in a different part of the service that doesn't now exist. It was called the specialist clinic. So I had a psychiatrist and a speech and language therapist. And, well, it's a bit of a whirlwind, really, but, yeah, within 45 minutes, I had an autism diagnosis, and I always say, like, I didn't realise it was that obvious.
You get used to working or interacting, behaving, whatever you want to describe it, in certain ways, and then actually you get completely blown apart by something like the pandemic, and that actually, yes, although we quite like working in certain ways, we actually can adapt. I think, bizarrely, I think it does encourage and promote greater team working and support of your colleagues and that, which sometimes can be missing, because we all have good days and bad days when you think, oh, just go away, leave me alone. But actually, you know, I think when times are difficult, and, you know, let's be honest, the pandemic went on for a long time, it does allow those relationships to flourish between colleagues and that, because you do share things more. I think for us, we worked much better as a team during that, which sounds a bit daft really, but actually I think it brought out some of the things that, you know, we'd forgotten that we were actually good at in working as a team.
This episode of Heads On's Living Histories podcast was produced as part of a collaboration between Heads On and Sussex Partnership NHS Foundation Trust. Living Histories was funded by the National Lottery Heritage Fund, NHS Charities Together and Heads On. We're deeply grateful to all the participants who shared their stories and to the many staff, volunteers and project partners who have made Living Histories possible. If you found this episode interesting and would like to hear more, please visit www.headsoncharity.org/histories, where you can learn more about Living Histories and listen to other episodes. If you've been affected by anything you've heard in this episode, support is available. Please visit www.sussexpartnership.nhs.uk/your-mental-health/getting-help. Audio production by Charlotte Petz and Michael Umney. Music by Chad Crouch. Narration by Living Histories volunteer Ian Barnett. oral history clips taken from full interviews with project participants from across Sussex for Heads On's Living Histories. For more information about Heads On's other projects, please visit www.headsoncharity.org.